You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1983 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the third class in a series given by Brother Steve Johnson on the subject, Lessons from David's Life.
Overhead that's up here, it's really only part of a verse, but don't go and look up the rest of it or you'll spoil the surprise. When I considered what this verse was saying for the first time, it really surprised me because I thought of David's life, in terms of David's life, the only real low point at the time of his problem with Bathsheba and Uriah the Hittite. But here we have, in an earlier part of David's life, a real low point. A really low point. David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him. His own people, his own men wanted to stone him, some of them, because they were very, very upset. They were bitter in soul for their own families. Well, how did that come to be? How did that situation occur? I think this low point came in David's life the same way low points come in our lives, gradually. Over a period of time, not suddenly, but through neglect and through not watching God's principles in our lives and being careful to always seek God's help. But backing up in the story and working our way up to this point in David's life, let's go back to 1 Samuel 18. Directly after his victory over Goliath, Saul took David and wouldn't let him return to his father's house, made him part of his army. And in verse 5, David went out and was successful wherever Saul sent him, so that Saul set him over the men of war. This was good in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. David was very successful, and Saul could have been a good manager. You know, some of us here, I guess, are managers of others in our jobs or professions. And a good manager can use people that have talents and praise them and let the praise go to them, and it builds up that person underneath them and makes them work better, and the manager gets a different kind of glory out of it. It's because his people are working well. Or a manager can be a bad manager, and this happens in the business world. People who have to get all the credit, and the people under them don't get any credit, although they're doing all the work. That's the situation we find developing here. Saul becomes a bad manager of his man David, because as they return from a victory over the Philistines, I'll suggest that in verse 6, when it says, when David returned from slaying the Philistine, there are texts that indicate that this is plural, slaying the Philistines in some of these wars. As they came back and David's name had been made now, the women all along the route on their way back home came out to meet them with a victory chant. The victory chant of Israel at this time was, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. That victory chant threw Saul, the bad manager, into a jealous rage, because now David was ascribed 10,000s, more than Saul, and it upset Saul deeply. And so comes the first spear incident, when Saul tried to pin David to the wall with his spear as David was playing his harp. But Saul promoted David, gave him a more dangerous job, perhaps, out on the front, where he's more likely to fall at the hand of the Philistines. And he promised him Merab, his oldest daughter. Perhaps this was fulfilling part of the reward that we're told about for slaying Goliath in 1 Samuel 17. Remember, the men said, David said, what will be done for the man who slays this giant? And one of the things was, well, he'll get the king's daughter in marriage. So Saul promises him Merab, but at the last minute, she was given to a fellow named Adriel the Moholathite. Can you imagine? David's out fighting Saul's battles, fighting the Lord's battles, and he comes home ready to make this marriage then with Merab, Saul's daughter, only to find, when he walks into town, somebody tells him, he says, where's Merab, or getting ready for this marriage, and he's told that she's been given to another man by Saul. That would be rather puzzling. But the significance, I think, in this event comes in understanding what Merab's name means, because it means increase. It's taken from the same root word that makes 10,000s out of thousands. There are two words in 10,000s, the word for thousands and then the word for 10 or multiplication. And that word is the same root word that's used that we get Merab from, or increase. And so we see how it is that Saul not only wished to take Merab away and took her away, but boy, did he ever wish he could take away David's 10,000s as well, and take away David's increase too. And to cap it all off, he promises to give David then Michal, if only his younger daughter, if only David will prove himself worthy of the task and put together a dowry of Philistine lives, hoping that David will fall in collecting those lives. But when David returns with the tokens of these Philistine deaths, Saul concedes and gives him Michal. And her name means a trickle, a rivulet, just a little bit. And that's certainly, as we know from the story, what she turns out to be. She does save David's life on one occasion, but later on, as you remember the story of David bringing the ark into Jerusalem, she comes out and ridicules him. She shows herself to be her father's daughter. She turns out to be a real trickle, not an increase like Merab. Look at the development of this relationship between Saul and David. It's really interesting how the Bible sketches this so quickly for us and how we see Saul change so quickly. Back in 1 Samuel 16 is the account of how Saul needed somebody to play the harp to relieve him of the evil spirit that God had sent upon him and the effects of that. David came to him and played for him, I think, serving in the role of a mediator here, and asking God to relieve Saul of this evil spirit, and God acting on David's behalf to relieve Saul of this, the oppression of the evil spirit. But it says in verse 21 that Saul loved him greatly. He loved him greatly for what David was able to do, how David was able to help Saul. Saul loved him for the benefit that he got from David. And in chapter 17, verse 55, after David had slain Goliath, he shows real interest in him now, not just for what he's done for him in relieving him from this evil spirit in the past. Now he shows a real interest in his family's house. He says, well, what house does he come from? There's a little more interest in David. But then we know that he becomes jealous. In chapter 18, chapter 18, verse 2, we see that Saul then took him for his own, took him for the benefit that David could do for Saul, and how he could help Saul. Then in verses 8 and 9, Saul was very angry, and this saying displeased him. He said, they've ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they've ascribed thousands. What more can he have but the kingdom? And Saul eyed David from that day on. He eyed him. You see the beginning here of jealousy and anger. The next step is in verse 12. Saul was afraid of David, because the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul. So now he's not only jealous, but he's afraid. And then verse 15, when Saul saw that he had great success, he stood in awe of him. So he's afraid, and then now he's removing himself from David and is in awe of David. Verse 29, Saul was still more afraid of David. Still more afraid. This fear is growing in him, and this jealousy and this anger. This whole situation is getting completely out of control. And finally, in verse 29, so Saul was David's enemy continually. Certainly note that David was not Saul's enemy continually. Saul became David's enemy. Why? Because of jealousy and anger. And the next step that happens as a result of jealousy, the last step is premeditated murder. In chapter 19, verse 1, Saul spoke to Jonathan and his son and to all his servants that they should kill David. You know, it's pretty bluntly stated there, but consider it. That's quite a step. Actually, coming out and talking to people about murdering another fellow who is fighting the Lord's battles. So, you see, jealousy leads to murderous intentions here in the story of David and Saul. How true James's words are in the New Testament in chapter 3, verse 16. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder and every vile practice. I think King James there says confusion for disorder. Where jealousy and selfish ambition exists, there's going to be disorder and confusion and every vile practice. We can be in three categories. Actually, I was talking to somebody about categories once. He said, yeah, well, really, there are two categories. There are those people who put people into categories, and then there's everybody else. But, you know, if you like considering categories of people, there are three categories, one way to break it down. They're Goliaths, Davids, and Sauls. The Goliaths of this world are those who serve sin and don't serve God and don't care to. The Davids of the world are those who work to overcome sin, not necessarily working against those who are the Goliaths to destroy them, but overcoming sin. They know who the real enemy is, the Davids do, and they're working in the right way. The third group are the Sauls, who don't recognize the right enemy. They don't see sin as the enemy. Instead, they're fighting the Davids. They're working against the Davids because of jealousy. Selfish ambition. We can all readily see how destructive jealousy was in Saul's life. That's easy to see. Very quickly we've seen it. Let's admit to ourselves that it's equally destructive to us nowadays. I'm going to make a confession of sorts. In that I speak from personal experience when it comes to jealousy and envy. And I know this has been a problem with me. It continues to be. And that's why I'm addressing it. But I also realize that not all people are afflicted with this error. But I think it's important. And that's why I wanted to talk about it just a little bit. Jealousy in our lives, and jealousy can come up in our ecclesias very easily, particularly where you have two brothers who see that things ought to go two different ways, and both are looking for power in the ecclesia, that sort of thing, or sisters even. Now, there's always conflict going on between us unless we recognize this and put it to rest and work for peace all the time. Jealousy, as James says, leads to confusion. It leads to confusion in our lives. It always leads to confusion in my life when I envy another brother because of what he is doing and able to do. There's no direction, there's no growth, there's no success in my life because of that confused state, because of disorder. And really, there's only one step, one next step from jealousy to the next worst position, which is hate. You know what John says, wrote about hate, 1 John 3:15. Anyone who hates his brother is a murderer. You know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. So this issue of envy and jealousy, as we work with each other, live with each other, is very important. We need to overcome it and deal with it in our own lives. But how do you do that? How do you overcome envy? And it's very difficult, insidious sort of a thing. You find that you're envying someone else who seems to be doing so well and succeeding so well in his work for the Lord, and you feel a little envious. Well, I think the first step, definitely in any sin, really, is to recognize it and admit it for what it is and say, this isn't right. This is not a good position to be in. And certainly the next thing to do is to stop destructive gossiping or talking about other people or these other people and looking for flaws in them and their characters. Remember this. It kind of boiled down this way for me. All of a sudden, a thought ran through my mind. God doesn't grade on a curve. You know, he doesn't take all of us and average us together and then sort of mete out rewards on a curve so that if there's somebody who's really a shining example, they're going to raise the average for all the rest of us and make things worse. God doesn't grade on a curve. We don't have to, he doesn't compare us to each other. He compares us to the one standard of Jesus. So if he doesn't do that, then there's no need for us to compare ourselves to each other and to find flaws in others so that we can, in our own mind, work to bring down the average and say, well, I'm really not that bad. Remember that. God doesn't grade on a curve. One thing that I found to be particularly helpful then, too, is once I've recognized that I'm envious of a certain person, is to pray specifically for the welfare of that person, for his success in the work that he's doing for the Lord, following the principle that we have in Philippians 2, 3 and 4. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. Do nothing from selfishness or conceit, but in humility count others better than yourselves. So we need to look out for each other's best interests and pray for each other's benefit, particularly if this envying is a problem. One last thought, too, that I found to be helpful, if this is a problem for you, then make yourself go to that person that you're jealous of and envious of, because chances are there's a problem in your relationship with that person already, in strife. Maybe you're not just not talking to that person. And go to them and confess. And it works. And you get closer because of it, because you confess this sin that you have toward this person. Avoid self-pity. You know, looking at yourself and saying, I don't seem to be blessed the way this other person is, or these other people are. Don't fret that others seem to be blessed while you seem to be ignored. Because this is really a protest against God's providential care for all his creatures. God is watching over each one of us and helping each one of us. And if we are envious of others, and fret about why are we ignored or seem to be ignored, we're not recognizing God's providential hand in our lives. David says, Psalm 37:8, do not fret. It tends only to evil. And he's right. Don't fret about anything, but in particular this one thing of looking at others and seeing differences. Well, Saul was determined to take David's life. And so in 1 Samuel 19, Michal does the one good thing that she did for David, that's recorded at any rate. She helps him escape. David goes out the window that night. Saul was planning to kill him in the morning, never to see that home again. Consider that. That is quite a thought. You know, can picture yourself in your home. Somebody's going to kill you in the morning. You have a chance to escape, and there you are in your bedroom. You slide open the window, you put one leg out, put the other leg out, and off into the night. Never to go back to that home again. That's what happened in David's life. He never went back there. Instead, he had years of living in caves, living day to day, looking after his immediate concerns of food and shelter, subject to all the elements. Enduring many sleepless nights, no doubt. Always on edge, waiting for Saul's next appearance over the next hill. That's what his life was like now, and it's recounted in the next 8 chapters here in Samuel. Many different experiences that came along. God always was with him, though, in helping him escape Saul's hand. Bear in mind that David at this time is right around 25 years old. 25. That seems so young. When I think about 25, I don't know that I could imagine a life like this. Somebody chasing me down, trying to kill me. It's quite a thought to think that he was only 25 years old, or right around that. But why this suffering? It was absolutely undeserved on David's part. He hadn't done anything at all to deserve this kind of treatment. Well, we alluded to it yesterday a bit. It was for his own growth, of course. We know how it was that Jesus learned obedience through the things that he suffered, as it says in Hebrews 5:8. And again, James 1:2 through 4. Count it all joy, my brethren, when you meet various trials, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. Let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. In Romans 5 again, the same idea, steadfastness leads to endurance, which produces hope. So, it's a step-by-step growth that we get from suffering, and David was getting this kind of growth himself. But I think another reason for it is the same kind of thing that's mentioned by Peter in his first letter, when he talks about the prophets who inquired about the sufferings of Christ, the Spirit of Christ that was in them, when predicting the sufferings of Christ. Because David, I think, here is a prophet, and God is letting him experience the sufferings of Christ. And what did David do? He wrote it down, didn't he? He wrote down his thoughts in the Psalms, filled them with all kinds of deep emotion about suffering. And why? Why did he do that? Who benefited from that besides us when we read them and have similar problems? Jesus benefited from it. God was preparing the way for his son to be helped through this man David. Imagine Jesus reading Psalm 86 in his life when he was being persecuted, always being challenged by the Jews. They were looking for ways to kill him all along, not just at the end, but from nearly the start. And Jesus could read, "Incline thy ear, O Lord, and answer me, for I am poor and needy. Preserve my life, for I am godly. Save thy servant who trusts in thee. Thou art my God. Be gracious to me, O Lord, for to thee do I cry all the day. Gladden the soul of thy servant, for to thee, O Lord, do I lift up my soul. For thou, O Lord, art good and forgiving, abounding in steadfast love to all who call on thee. Give ear, O Lord, to my prayer. Hearken to the voice of my supplication. In the day of my trouble I call on thee, for thou dost answer me." And the Psalms are filled with messages like that for Jesus to read and be helped. In fleeing for his life, he makes a trip to Ramah, comes back down to Jerusalem, then leaves there, goes on his way to the land of the Philistines to try to live in Gath for the first time. He stops at Nob, where the tabernacle has been set up, and he retrieves Goliath's sword from there. The interesting thing to think about is that Goliath's sword to Goliath, absolutely no good. And here in this case, really, Goliath's sword does David absolutely no good. I think maybe there's some sort of lesson there. At any rate, when he goes to Gath, it would become a definite liability for him because he's not received the way he thought he would be. In fact, he's taken prisoner. I think that's pointed out in Psalm 56, one of the two psalms that deals with this period in David's life. As the heading says, a miktam of David when the Philistines seized him in Gath. They held him, and look in verse 5, it says, "All day long they seek to injure my cause." So David was held there for a period of time, and these Philistines were trying to injure his cause. They were trying to have him done in. He's a marked man. It would seem to me that leaving Israel was a real mistake for him at this point. And he's humbled by it. And he doesn't leave Israel again for quite some time. God delivers him. But he talks about how he was humbled in this experience in Psalm 34, which says that it's a psalm of David when he feigned madness before Abimelech so that he drove him out and he went away. In verse 6 and 7, David says, "This poor man cried, and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and delivers them. Listen to how he talks about how he was humbled and broken by this experience in verses 18 and 19. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. So he comes back out of Gath after pretending to be crazy. They drive him away. Achish says, well, I don't have any need of madmen in my house. Get him out of here. Perhaps afraid that whatever spirit was afflicting David would leave him and enter his house and afflict Achish then. He says, drive him away. So David returns to a very lonely spot, the cave of Adullam, tells us in chapter 22, verse 1. We might ask, why does he go there? Well, the Bible dictionaries I consulted all said that the cave of Adullam is located in the valley of Elah, which, of course, was the scene of David's great victory over Goliath, his great moment of faith when he destroyed the Philistine giant. And I think that he's looking for strength from that former great faith by returning there to this cave in the valley of Elah, considering his past and where he is now. It's a very lonely scene as well. Psalm 142, I think, may well have been written at this time. The heading says, a maskil of David when he was in the cave. Granted, he was in many caves, but listen to this. A prayer. I cry with my voice to the Lord. With my voice I make supplication to the Lord. I pour out my complaint before him. I tell my trouble before him. When my spirit is faint, thou knowest my way. In the path where I walk, they've hidden a trap for me. I look to the right and watch, but there is none who takes notice of me. No refuge remains to me. No man cares for me. I cry to thee, O Lord. I say, thou art my refuge, my portion in the land of the living. Give heed to my cry, for I am brought very low. Deliver me from my persecutors, for they are too strong for me. Bring me out of prison, that I may give thanks to thy name. The righteous will surround me, for thou wilt deal bountifully with me. He says, the righteous will surround me. And isn't it interesting that in fact God answers his prayer and surrounds him with people? 1 Samuel 22 tells us that when David there was there in the cave of Adullam, his brothers and all his father's house heard of it and went down there. But notice in verse 2, everyone who was in distress and everyone who was in debt and everyone who was discontented gathered to him, and he became captain over them. There were added to him about 400 men. There were with him about 400 men. You see what God did? David had his own problems. He was so low. Lord God, hear my troubles. Deliver me. What does God do? He sends in people with troubles and problems, as if David didn't have enough of his own. God says, here, you take all that are discontented, all who are in debt, all these people who have problems, you help them. And he does. He becomes captain over them. He molds them into a group of fighting men, profitable men, who are able to defend the shepherds and the wilderness region of Judah, the shepherds of Nabal, as an example. They weren't to be idle, though. So in verse 5, after David has taken his family to Moab, God says, through Gad, don't remain in the stronghold. Depart and go into the land of Judah. So God knows that idleness is not good. And he says, go into the land of Judah. I'll give you things to do. And in fact, I think David then becomes privy to the information that he hears in chapter 23, verse 1, when it says, now they told David, the Philistines are fighting against Keilah. And he goes down there and delivers Keilah from the hand of the Philistines. So you see, by getting David moving, giving him work to do, giving him people with problems to help, God was solving David's problem. Another beautiful scene from this period is in 1 Samuel 23, verses 14 through 18, along the same line. It says, David remained in the strongholds in the wilderness, in the hill country of the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul sought him every day, but God did not give him into his hand. David was afraid, David was afraid again. Here he's afraid now. Does this indicate that suddenly he's going down just a bit, wavering, wondering what to do? Because Saul had come out to seek his life, David was in the wilderness of Ziph at Horesh. And Jonathan, Saul's son, rose and went to David at Horesh and strengthened his hand in God. And he said to him, "Fear not, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find you. You shall be king over Israel, and I shall be next to you. Saul my father also knows this." The two of them made a covenant before the Lord, and David remained at Horesh, and Jonathan went home. Now, isn't it interesting that Saul was seeking David every day and couldn't find him because God was delivering him out of his hand? And yet, Jonathan makes a beeline for him, finds him right away. Why? It's obvious. God was leading Jonathan there. God was moving Jonathan to work and help David, his friend. God was behind this, helping. So how was it accomplished? How did Jonathan strengthen David's hand in God? Well, let's look at three quick examples of this for our own benefit. Job 4, 3 and 4, we begin to see how it is that we can strengthen someone else's hand in the Lord. Eliphaz the Temanite, talking about Job, says, "Behold, you have instructed many, and you have strengthened the weak hands. Your words have upheld him who was stumbling, and you have made firm the feeble knees." So it's through the spoken word, through speaking, that Job lifted others up and helped them by talking to them. And Job himself says in chapter 16, verse 5, "I could strengthen you with my mouth, and the solace of my lips would assuage your pain," Job says. So he knew how to lift people up and strengthen them. How? By talking, by communicating with someone who's in trouble and needs help, talking to them. In Nehemiah, we get some more information about strengthening someone's hand in the Lord. Nehemiah 2, verses 17 and 18. Nehemiah said to them, "You see the trouble we're in, how Jerusalem lies in ruins with its gates burned. Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem, that we may no longer suffer disgrace." And I told them of the hand of my God, which had been upon me for good, and also of the words which the king had spoken to me. And they said, "Let us rise up and build." So they strengthened their hands for the good work. And there we see that it was Nehemiah's testimonial about how God had been helping him. Nehemiah recognizing providence in his life and telling another person who needed strengthening about it, saying, "Yes, God's worked in my life, here's how," and talking about that. Deuteronomy 3:28, God told Moses to charge Joshua and encourage and strengthen him, for he shall go over at the head of this people. God wanted Joshua to be encouraged and strengthened. And how was it that this was accomplished? In Numbers 27, we see what Moses did then in carrying this directive of God out. 18 through 23. The Lord said to Moses, "Take Joshua, the son of Nun, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand upon him. Cause him to stand before Eleazar the priest and all the congregation, and you shall commission him in their sight. You shall invest him with some of your authority that all the congregation of the people of Israel may obey. And he shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire for him by the judgment of the Urim before the Lord. At his word they shall go out, and at his word they shall come in, both he and all the people of Israel with him, the whole congregation." Moses did as the Lord commanded him. He took Joshua, caused him to stand before Eleazar the priest and the whole congregation, and he laid his hands upon him and commissioned him as the Lord directed through Moses. And of course, this is a very special event. But I think from it we see that the association with the man in front of all the people, laying his hands on him, showing that he was with this man, strengthened Joshua's hand for the work. So association with people associating ourselves with those who are brought low and building them up, showing that we are with this person, will build that person's spirit up as others see that we're associating with the one who is downtrodden. Jonathan encouraged David with positive talk. He reminded him of the coming kingship, David's coming kingship, and how it was that God had promised him. So he reminded him of things that had been promised. That's important for us to remember. And I think the key then, or the thing to note, is that when David had started out being afraid, his friend Jonathan now had strengthened in his hand in the Lord to the point that David remained at Horesh. He stayed there. He stayed put, confident in God's protective power and help in his life. From Acts 2:42, you know, there are four things listed there as essentials: the apostles' teaching, fellowship, the breaking of bread, and prayers. Fellowship is an essential in our lives. Fellowshipping with other people, associating with our brothers and sisters, speaking to them to build them up and strengthen each other's hands in the Lord. If we're down, we need to look for others who are down too, to lift them up, not be concerned with our problems, because in doing that, our problems will seem to be less. But if we're up, we need to look for others to encourage, just as Jonathan did, and strengthen each other's hand in the Lord. It's essential. It's one of the four essential things for us to do, is to help each other through fellowship. But still, time dragged by. There were narrow escapes from death for David, from Saul, until one day, it would seem that the pressure of this kind of life became too much for David. In 1 Samuel 27, David said in his heart, I think that's very telling, a very telling phrase, considering all that we've learned about hearts, God looking at hearts. David said in his heart, I shall now perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than that I should escape to the land of the Philistines. Then Saul will despair of seeking me any longer within the borders of Israel. I shall escape out of his hand. It's easy to condemn somebody in the Bible because they're not here to defend themselves. You know, it's easy to say he made a mistake. And I've already talked to a brother here about this who doesn't see it quite this way. But perhaps this is the way we should look at things like this. The Bible is given for our instruction. It's very clear. There are at least three passages like that in the New Testament that say it's the Bible is written. What was written in the past is for our instruction. So we're to look at it in that light and see here things to apply to our own life. I think what's happening here in David's mind is understandable. Okay, no question there. We understand it. We can see why he got to this low point. No problem. But there's a difference between that and acceptability of it. We can understand it, but that doesn't mean it's acceptable behavior. And instead of condemning David for this mistake, we need to look at it in our own, in the context of our own lives and learn a lesson here about trusting in God, putting our plans before God, seeing that God's will is being done in the kinds of things that we plan to do. David at this point is 28 years old, and that's firm. He's 28 years old at this point. And consider that he has the burden now of two wives. Wives are not a burden. But, on the other hand, if you're running around in a wilderness, dragging a family. David didn't have any children at this point, apparently, but he had two wives to look after their needs. He had about 600 men at this time, and some of them did have families by this time. You know, listen, that it's understandable that David would despair and say, I'm tired of this. I've got to do something. I can't keep running like this. He says in Psalm 13, perhaps something like this going through his mind, How long, O Lord, wilt thou forget me forever? How long wilt thou hide thy face from me? He despairs nothing better than that I should go to the land of the Philistines. And apparently, according to the record, he doesn't consult the Urim or the Thummim that he has with him, with Abiathar the priest who would run to him, as before. But he makes a decision based on the outward appearance of things, the way things look to his natural mind. And we see, don't we, how it is that without prayer, without constantly keeping in touch with God and his word, that we can continue to fall into the same cycle of sins. Because here David didn't have a good experience the first time he went to the land of the Philistines. And now without God, without consulting God, he goes through the same pattern again and goes back to the land of the Philistines. This time, however, he does get a better reception. Perhaps the answer lies there in the fact that this may be a different Achish. Achish, as I understand it, is much like the word for Pharaoh. It's a king. It can be a title as well as a proper name. Perhaps this is a different fellow than the first one. At any rate, or perhaps it's because David now has a power base. He has 600 warriors, and he can sell his services much better to the Philistines as a mercenary band. But note that he's with the Lord's enemies now, living among them, and by that, countenancing their way of life to some degree. He's making compromises in his life. And note this irony in chapter 28, verse 2. Achish was quite pleased with David's performance. He says, "Understand that you and your men are to go out with me in the army." David said to Achish, "Very well. You shall know what your servant can do." Achish said, "Very well, I will make you my bodyguard for life." What does your King James Version say? "I will make you the keeper of my head," right? I think. And that's literally what the words are. "I'll make you the keeper of my head." Well, isn't that ironic? David certainly had been a keeper of another Philistine's head earlier on. Now, in quite a different sense, he's protecting Achish, king of the Philistines. David begins leading a double life, doesn't he? Telling half-truths, really. Misleading Achish. The half-truths are whole lies. So David is living a lie, really, fundamentally. I think the thing to notice here, too, is 1 Samuel 27:7. "The number of the days that David dwelt in the country of the Philistines was a year and 4 months." A year and 4 months. A lot can happen in a year and a half. I mean, you know that from your own life. That's a short time on one hand, but really, day-to-day sort of living, that's a long time for David to be there, living in the land of the Philistines. I think the lesson we can learn is that a bad decision that we make can take a long time to manifest itself, that we'll realize that we did make a bad decision. And it really enforces the lesson in our own lives that we need to consult God's word and understand his will for us in all the decisions that we make, large and small, particularly the big ones, because we may not find out how bad a decision it's been until years go by and much pain ensues. But it becomes apparent for David that he made a mistake in 1 Samuel 29. Look at verse 1. "Now the Philistines gathered all their forces at Aphek," all of them, a massing of the Philistines for battle against Israel. And it's significant that they're gathering at Aphek, because when you refer back to 1 Samuel 4:1, an earlier time in Israel's history, when all the Philistines gathered, they gathered at Aphek, and they overthrew the Israelites and captured the ark. The glory departed from Israel that day. So isn't it interesting? History repeats itself. But, and Achish here requires David's attendance, doesn't he? And I think that's where David must have, in his mind, been thinking, I have made a mistake. Now I have a problem to deal with. But the other lords, when they see David and his men there, are aghast. They say, "What are these Hebrews doing here?" They look at Achish like he's nuts and say, Have you lost your mind? This is David, of whom they say David has slain his 10,000s. And note, they say, look at these Hebrews here. And well, they might say that. Look at 1 Chronicles 12 and see who these Hebrews were that were there with David. Verse 1, now these are the men who came to David at Ziklag while he could not move about freely because of Saul the son of Kish. They were among the mighty men who helped him in war. They were bowmen and could shoot arrows and sling stones with either right hand or left hand. Boy, they were handy warriors, ambidextrous. And notice who they are. They were Benjaminites, Saul's kinsmen. Saul's having problems. And go on here, verse 8. From the Gadites there went over to David at the stronghold in the wilderness mighty and experienced warriors, expert with sword, shield and spear, whose faces were like the faces of lions, who were swift as gazelles upon the mountains. It lists them. Expert warriors here with David now in the land of the Philistines. Verse 19, some of the men of Manasseh deserted to David when he came with the Philistines for the battle against Saul. That's right now. That's what we're talking about right now. Deserters from Saul's army had come to David in the night. In verse 21, they helped David against the band of raiders, for they were all mighty men of valor and were commanders in the army. Whose army? Saul's army. These were commanders in Saul's army who deserted during the night and came to David while he was down at Ziklag, or actually as he's returning from being rejected by the lords of the Philistines. No wonder in 1 Samuel 28, 5, when it says, when Saul saw the army of the Philistines, he was afraid and his heart trembled greatly. No question why. Every morning he was waking up and there were more people from his army gone. He had nobody left. He was left alone, virtually, with his sons and some others who were more faithful. He was, in the Hebrew here, trembled greatly is terrified, knees knocking. It's terrified. He had no army left. God used the lords of the Philistines, though, to extricate David from this bind that he had gotten himself into with his bad decision. Their assessment of the situation is probably right. David probably would have turned or was planning to turn in the battle and help Saul, deliver Saul with these men. I think that's reasonable to assume. But notice, God didn't want David to help Saul. He didn't want him there. And so he used the lords of the Philistines to send David back home. Because Saul's time was up. God was meting out the judgment that he had predicted, prophesied before, years before. As it says in 1 Chronicles 10:14, the Lord slew Saul. It makes that point clear. The Lord slew Saul using the arrows of the Philistines. Well, actually, Saul, as you recall, fell on his own sword, pressed to do so by the Philistines. Now watch how perfect God's timing is. This will illustrate how in control of everything God is. David and his men leave the Philistine camp very early the next morning after their rejection. 1 Samuel 31 tells us it's a 3-day journey. And consider that they had very happy expectations of seeing their wives and their children, and to rest up in their homes a bit. They come over the last hill, and lo and behold, a harsh reality, a smoldering embers there, Ziklag's in ruins. Imagine that yourself. Maybe some of you have experienced this. I haven't. I try to brace myself for it and prepare myself for it, really. Going off to the store one day, and you come back, you're not expecting this. Come around the last corner and pull up in front of your house and there are the firemen dousing the last cinders. And everything that you had is gone. And your first question is, where are my families? Where are my wives and children? And so it's no wonder that David reaches this low point and all the people with him. Then David and the people who were with him raised their voices and wept until they had no more strength to weep. David's two wives also had been taken captive, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. And David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, because all the people were bitter in soul, each for his sons and daughters. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. It's interesting that every use of this word, greatly distressed, in the Bible, in every use of it, people turn as a result of it. It's a terrible trauma. It's something none of us wants to go through, this kind of great distress. It's what Jacob experienced when Esau was coming, and Jacob thought that Esau was going to kill him. He was greatly distressed. It's the distress that the Israelites felt during the period of the judges when they were oppressed and greatly distressed. And in both of those cases, and now in this case, it causes something to happen. The result is the same. People turn to God in earnest prayer as a result of this great distress. And so with David, he strengthened himself in the Lord his God, and his immediate next step was this: bring me the ephod. Perhaps the first time in a year, and over a year, he's now consulting God and says, God, help. Shall I pursue? God says, you shall surely overtake and shall surely rescue. And look at what great faith does. Against a horde of the Amalekites in verse 16, behold, they were spread abroad over all the land, eating and drinking and dancing. David, with 400 men, took them on, recovered everything that he'd lost, lost nothing, it says. And notice God's irony, that while David is smiting the Amalekites in the south, Saul is being overwhelmed by the Philistines in the north. And I think the point is they're happening at exactly the same time, if you look at the timing here. These battles going on at exactly the same time. Saul being executed for his failure to utterly destroy the Amalekites. David destroying them as completely as he could this time. Very quickly, let me summarize then these lessons. Our points to notice for today. Remember, first of all, how important fellowship is. It's essential to us. We need to look for ways to help each other and build each other up. Secondly, remember that God is in control completely. Remember the timing here. If David hadn't been away from Ziklag, he probably would have successfully defended it from the Philistines, or from the Amalekites. And he would have missed the chastisement that came and the resulting turning about in his heart. The great blessing that resulted. He would have missed that, you see, if he'd been there. But if he'd been gone more than 3 days' journey away before the Philistines sent him home, or if he'd gone to the battle at Gilboa, it may have been too late to recover everything intact, right? They would have sold the women as slaves or done something worse with them. But the timing was perfect for David to overtake and recover everything intact. God controlled events for David. He'll work in our best interests too, if we let him. And follow this principle, Proverbs 3, 5 through 8. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do not rely on your own insight. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will make straight your paths. Be not wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and turn away from evil. It will be healing to your flesh and refreshment to your bones.